This week on Making Contact.
I don't call art something that just sells or is something that just brings in dollars. That is not art. Art is something that really comes from your essence, you know, and from the inside and works its way out.
The best work and sometimes the most meaningful work will not be immediately realized in terms of a return, a financial return, but is important to the overall fabric of the culture and civilization that we live in.
These days, public funding for the arts is closely linked with economic returns. Meanwhile, private corporations are stepping in as sponsors. But what are the implications when art has to satisfy an economic equation? On this program, we take a look at art and democracy. I'm Philip Babbage, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In recent years, the National Endowment for the Arts has come under attack from some members of Congress and conservative organizations. Most of the criticism has been directed at controversial art that the NEA has funded. But the NEA and its supporters have also had to argue for the agency's overall relevance in order to fend off deep budget cuts and attempts to eliminate the agency altogether. The NEA is a primary source of funding for thousands of artists and art education programs across the United States. It also serves, in a sense, as a central agency of culture, issuing opinions about the importance of art in U.S. society. Today, however, the NEA finds itself having to justify art and culture in economic terms, as government programs need to prove they can be buoyant on the choppy waters of privatization. In fact, many schools, especially those in poor inner-city neighborhoods, no longer have art or music programs. Defending art has raised some central questions about the value of ideas and self-expression, abstract items difficult to put a price tag on. Fred Ho is a Chinese-American jazz musician and writer. His book, Sounding Off, Music as Subversion, Resistance, Revolution, won the 1997 American Book Award. Ho says that vibrant art culture is essential to democracy.
Art is democracy. The freedom of artistic expression, the diversification of artist expressions, and the radicalization, the radicalizing expressions are all essential to having democratic spirit and practices in society. Without them, we don't have democracy, you know, and that's what should be a lesson to all of us in the changes that have gone on in the National Endowment for the Arts, which is, you know, America's so-called cultural ministry, even though America's never had a minister of culture compared to other industrialized countries in the world. But that with the restrictions on content, with the privileging of institutions versus individual artists, or having happen is the complete undermining of democracy in American culture and basically paving the way for corporate takeover in the sense that Disney, Spielberg, Geffen, those folks are going to be doing the cultural programming in America and not from the communities or from the artists themselves.
Political art, in particular, has had a difficult time receiving funding and gaining access to wide audiences. Joan Holden is principal playwright for the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which performs political theater.
There's a very strong taboo in American art against dealing with public issues, against dealing with political issues, which I think goes back to McCarthyism. 10 years of education against content, formalistic education, aesthetic education, convinced artists that what is important is the form, is the purity of the expression, and, you know, the beauty of what you create, and the content is an impediment to good art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we attack, by proving that you can do good art that has content.
Mm-hmm. And so were those messages, or those are academic messages?
But I think they were academic, but they were also put forth very clearly by the critics and by the producers and by the financing system, what you couldn't and couldn't get on. I mean, there was a revolt. There are natural aesthetic revolts, and there was a revolt in the 50s against the social realism of the 40s. That's kind of natural. That would have happened anyway. But that it should be so long-lasting has to do with a consistent message that comes from all the institutional aspects of the culture, I think, mm-hmm. that politics has nothing to do with art. Mm-hmm. And my point of view as a writer is that politics is just like any other content. People write about what they're interested in. Some people write about the family. Some people write about sex. Some people write about individual psychology. And I write about politics. Why should that be any different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you think it's a fallacy that some expression could be completely apolitical anyway? I mean, isn't promoting the status quo, or at least coming from a very mainstream perspective, political in some way?
You know, there's this famous statement of Brecht, the artist who chooses to remain above politics has merely chosen the side of the ruling class. Mm-hmm. Obviously, everything has a political effect and a political meaning, but I don't think that all artists have to be responsible for their political meanings, because I think an artist, it's a very strange profession. You are some kind of mirror, some kind of sounding board, something that reverberates, an instrument that vibrates, a miner's canary, and the process is largely unconscious, even for somebody like me who writes very topical stuff. I write about what makes me personally enraged. And obviously, there's a whole lot of unconscious stuff in there. It's not a purely intellectual process. So I think that I don't believe in applying a political test to art from any direction.
Art for art's sake is a philosophical position about art and artists promoted by the ruling class, by the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, that basically asserts two things.
Fred Ho.
One, that the best art is completely transcendental and above society and doesn't concern itself with society, doesn't dirty its hands, so to speak. And the second position is that art and politics don't mix, that they don't mix and they shouldn't mix. And I think both of these positions are wrong. I think that they come from a class viewpoint heavily influenced by Western European bourgeois culture that tries to divorce the arts and the artist from a social context. And I don't think that's ever happened. I don't think that that's a real situation, that all artists and their work are a product of their social conditions and circumstances, whether it be looking at the very particular kind of training they receive, the vocabulary, the very aesthetic principles that they operate from, but also, I'm talking about training and education, but also who they think their audience is and how they find their support. So I think that, that notion is a fallacy. And I've always believed that the best and strongest art, particularly from the traditions of oppressed people, evoke and demand their liberation.
That was Fred Ho in the Monkey Orchestra with the song titled Monkey's Origin. The National Endowment for the Arts was established in 1965. Currently, taxpayers contribute less than 40 cents per year to fund the NEA, an infinitesimal fraction of the total federal budget. There have been several attempts to zero out the NEA completely, including efforts by former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, Senator Jesse Helms, and Senator John Ashcroft. But these attempts have been unsuccessful. There is broad public support for funding the arts, according to a 1996 national poll, which found that Americans favor current government-funded arts programs by a margin of 3-1. NEA Chairman Bill Ivey has managed to increase congressional funding for the NEA by pointing to the economic importance of art. For example, in a speech he made on April 15, 1999, in Silicon Valley, he said that, quote, art has become big business. Nationwide, the arts contribute $315 billion to the American economy. That's 6% of the gross national product. He went on to say the nonprofits alone generate almost $37 billion. Also, according to the NEA's website, the artist workforce has grown to nearly 1.7 million people. Martina Spada is a professor of English at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He won the 1996 American Book Award for his collection of poetry titled Imagine the Angels of Bread. I asked Espada, who has served on NEA grant panels, if he thought that part of the NEA's role was to monitor the economy of art.
The NEA, over the years, has tried to find ways to express its relevance. It's tried to find ways to survive. Of course, as we know, every so often Congress attempts to eliminate the NEA. The NEA has had to craft all kinds of arguments to justify its very existence. I think this is one more of those arguments. I think the primary argument for art, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that it serves the community or serves humanity in a larger way. And, you know, its economic viability, I think, is a distant second. Having said that, I understand why they're making that particular argument.
Well, there's another argument that's put out there that private funding can ensure freedom of expression, and that opinion was expressed in an article in the Hartford Advocate. The article was titled "The Tobacco Industry Special Interests: Art World in Bed with Philip Morris." Writer Jane Keedle quotes Sharon Luckman, executive director of the of Alvin Ailey, as saying, quote, "The NEA has put all kinds of censorship language into their grants. Philip Morris has never meddled in the artistic product, never asked us to change our artistic product in any way, which makes them wonderful funders." Philip Morris, of course, is the multinational tobacco company. What's your response to that view?
I think that's perverse. On the one hand, I agree that the NEA has seriously compromised itself by including censorship language of the kind that you alluded to. I think the NEA has repeatedly bowed to pressure over the last decade or so, and the results have been disastrous. On the other hand, I do not think the solution to our problems is Philip Morris. Philip Morris may not interfere with the content of a given presentation. It may not interfere directly, but it interferes in other ways. Private foundations make choices, and the panels they designate make choices. Those choices very rarely reflect the diversity of art and literature in our country today. They very rarely reflect diversity in terms of race, culture, language, ethnicity. Every now and then, exceptions are made, in fact, for the sake of that foundation's credibility. But we cannot turn to Philip Morris or its ilk for democracy. Corporations, are inherently undemocratic. And I have seen, I've been on the other side of the fence. I've served on a panel for Lila Wallace Reader's Digest. And, you know, I can tell you that was a much less democratic process than one I witnessed at the NEA.
Mm-hmm. If the NEA were more free to support art perhaps more fully on all levels, what then would, how would it support art and its role in democracy? That is, what do you think the NEA's role should be in supporting art and democracy and furthering democratic values?
Well, I think the NEA exists to support the kind of art that will not be supported by the so-called free market. I think all too often, of course, conservatives are telling us to let the market sort things out. Well, the market sorts things out in a way that's cold-blooded and brutal, and in a way that certainly would not benefit the arts or literature as I know them. The NEA exists to compensate for that which the market will not recognize, will not honor. And I think that means specifically, let's say, in the case of poetry, that the NEA should be doing everything it can to support poetry. I mean, poetry is one of those forms that's not going to get widespread support in the so-called free market. And I think it's particularly true of, political poets, progressive poets, are trying to put a message out there with their poetry. We can't expect that kind of art to be supported by, let's say, Philip Morris, or even more directly, the kinds of foundations that give awards to poets, but very rarely political poets. The NEA has to be there for those kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible for artists, in your opinion, to create truly revolutionary original art within the capitalist culture that seeks to co-opt anything that resonates with a group of people, anything that can be seen as a moneymaker? Is that type of art still possible?
Revolutionary art has always been created in that kind of context. Mm. Revolutionary art has always been created in the context of that which needs to be rebelled against. The best example I could point to would be Diego Rivera. You know, Diego Rivera not only created the murals that have become such an important chronicle of Mexican history in Mexico. he also came to this country and he created murals which exist, I think there's in Detroit and San Francisco. And in fact, there was one in notorious incident of censorship for Diego Rivera at the Rockefeller Center in New York. But the bottom line is Diego Rivera was creating this revolutionary art in a capitalist context. And if you look at the art today, it still inspires us to make radical social change.
Martín Espada, professor of English at the University of Massachusetts. We'll have more about the NEA's position on art and the economy after this short break.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we'll be giving out our toll-free number at the end of this broadcast.
The NEA has been the subject of controversy over the years. In 1989, a series of homoerotic photographs by Robert Mapplethorpe was scheduled to be displayed at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. The exhibit had received some of its funding from the NEA, but the show was canceled due to pressure from right-wing groups. In a June 1998 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the NEA's decency clause, which requires the NEA chairperson to consider, quote, general standards of respect and decency for the diverse beliefs and values of the American public when awarding art grants. The Supreme Court's decision overturned a federal court ruling that had previously found the NEA's decency clause unconstitutional. The case involved the so-called NEA Four, artists Karen Finley, John Fleck, Holly Hughes, and Tim Miller, who argued that in order to obtain NEA funding, they would have to engage in self-censorship. Most recently, NEA Chairman Bill Ivey canceled a grant for a Latino publisher in El Paso, Texas, which sought funding to print a children's book titled The Story of Colors, A Tale About Mayan Gods. Ivey said he pulled the funding to prevent the author, Mexican revolutionary Subcomandante Marcos, from receiving any of the money. Now, Ivey is perhaps refashioning the NEA's image. He's managed to increase the NEA's budget by appealing to the economic value of art, and some observers say that even though it is not yet clear how Ivey's fundraising tactics will play out, he may be instrumental in preserving the NEA. Joan Holden of the San Francisco Mime Troupe says that Ivey's argument that supporting the arts will help local economies could be effective.
Actually, as long as he makes that argument in a general way, art in general will bring people to your center cities, and he doesn't apply it. You know, he doesn't apply the test to each applicant. How many people will come to see this sculptor's work, or how many people will come to listen to this poet? As long as he doesn't apply it case by case, but applies it in general, it's a very useful argument with city governments and business people. And it's a good one to make, and it's the philosophy of that served San Francisco really well with Grants for the Arts, the program which is funded by the hotel tax and which gives basically everybody, every arts organization in San Francisco, a certain percentage of their budget every year without asking, without imposing any other test. Do you have a program? Are you active? Are people coming to see your stuff? Okay, then you get the money. And it's great. And I think that's exactly it's less painstaking than the NEA's process because in relative to the size of the city, Grants for the Arts has a lot much more money to go around and can just spread it very liberally. I think that's a great policy. So I'm not against that argument. Certainly it's very important for people to be speak to Congress and everybody else about the basic human value of art. Mm-hmm. But whether that has to be the NEA chairman at this point, if he's not making the argument, then everybody else should be making the argument.
Bureaucrats have to make the arguments that they have to make. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily have to be the correct or the right arguments, but I understand why they make them.
Musician Fred Ho.
However, this cost-benefit argument to defend the arts, to defend affirmative action and social programs is a very seriously flawed one in the sense that its audience is not targeted to the masses of people, to the communities, but targeted to basically CEOs and corporate powers to political powers who want to, get corporate backing. The cost-benefit analysis is one argument, but I don't think it's the major or necessarily the most important argument. The most important argument, like scientific research, like any form of experimentation or intellectual or cultural engagement area, that the best work and sometimes the most meaningful work will not be immediately realized in terms of a return, a financial return, but is important to the overall fabric of the culture and civilization that we live in, the values that we espouse, hopefully democratic ones, hopefully values for diversity as well as for critical thinking and so forth, that artistic experimentation and chances, if you will, are critical to developing an investigation of thought and ideas, to promoting a diverse forms of expression, and to really perpetuating democracy in the society. And if we narrow it down to cost-benefit, then we're saying that democracy is only something we should support because somehow it supports free enterprise, you know, or really profit-making.
That was Quarter Roy by Zebra Bravo from the Images Creating Unity program at the East Bay Institute for Urban Arts. The East Bay Institute for Urban Arts in Oakland, California, is a community arts training and resource center that offers apprenticeships, residencies, and commissions to youth and adults in the community. Visual, performing, and media artists make up the multiracial and multigenerational staff at Urban Arts. Hasina Johnson is a 20-year-old visual artist who attended the Community Arts Apprenticeship Program and then became a board member at Urban Arts. She says that the organization is an example of positive community support for the arts, especially for young people of color. Making Contact's Shireen Meraji asked Johnson about political controversy surrounding some of the projects at Urban Arts.
There have been a couple pieces that have really rubbed, I think, society and just political arenas, you know, the wrong way. One of which is a mural that's been done at Oakland Technical High School in Oakland. And that piece actually displays and portrays just a young woman, a young interracial couple who have, you know, had a child really early. And it just shows like the pollution and the turmoil that's going around them. You know, there's drugs, there's alcoholism, there's, you know, high electrical towers and just all kinds of, you know, things that are making it difficult for them to survive. And because of its content, they were asked to remove the mural or to censor it, to change it in a lot of ways because they didn't agree with what it spoke out on. You know, they didn't think that, you know, the woman depicted or the young girl depicted in the mural was diverse enough. She was too black, and the, you know, the guy in the mural was he Asian, you know, and people didn't like it. You know, people thought it didn't represent Oakland in the best light. But from the students' perspective, it represented Oakland as they saw it.
I want to talk about art as a medium of politicizing young people and how young people are using art to get their voices heard in a society where a lot of times young people's voices are silenced. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I can tell you what I know from Urban Arts. As a student there, we participated in a workshop with the Center for Third World Organizing, which is based out of Oakland. And basically C2 did a workshop on just educating the students of Urban Arts on how to really speak out and how to learn how to organize people and activities, how to really mobilize people to demonstrate or to participate and things like that. And one of the things that Urban Arts is known for too is creating music and performing those pieces live, you know, in the city streets, you know, like City Center in downtown Oakland. You know, they've been, you know, asked to leave there. I was asked to leave there at one point in 97, you know, because of a piece that we were performing. And, you know, people didn't like it. They didn't necessarily think that, you know, it was the right time or the right place to perform a piece that really challenged, you know, the officials of Oakland. And, I mean, in other ways, we've produced just, you know, comical, like, flyers, you know, talking about how we see the politicians and what they're doing in our communities, or the lack of acknowledgement of the things that are going on in inner cities.
As an up-and-coming artist, I'm sure you've thought about having a career in the arts. And how do you keep your vision uncompromised, this revolutionary vision that you have, this, you know, vision to help change society for the better, when we live in this mercantile culture where commercialism and corporatization abounds? I mean, how do you keep your vision uncompromised and still be able to make a living out of your artwork? And do you have any advice for other young people on how to do this?
I think that, you know, now's the time. It's very difficult, you know, to stay focused on the things that are so close to your heart, or the things that are deepest and really, you know, essential to who you are. And I think it's really just about staying true to yourself. And I know that, you know, even with myself, it's like, you know, in a lot of ways, I know what art can sell, but it's not the art that I want to do, or it's not the art that best represents who I am or what I believe in. And I think, you know, that's something that, you know, even through urban arts, I've really learned and started to really understand better, is who I am as an artist and what that means and what that stands for. I don't just represent myself, but I represent my community. I represent the world as a Black woman. And I think that that's something that's really important, that, you know, artists as a whole, you know, I mean, people can say that you're a sellout because you're commercializing your art or you're selling your art. But if it comes from the heart and it sells, then that's fine.
Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about how they can help, you know, support youth and, you know, support artistic programs in the schools? And
there's a lot of ways people can help out. I believe people need to take the responsibility onto themselves to go out there and find, you know, the place that's close to home that really helps students or really helps young people. And if they're not the ones to, if they don't see it, then they need to start creating places that are havens, places that are sanctuaries for young people to come and really be themselves and really express themselves and really grow, not just in a I guess academic way, but there's so many other, you know, aspects of life that I think are so much neglected in the Western world, that, you know, students and young people are not able to really get fulfilled. You know, they're not whole because they lack so much. They lack so much of art. They lack so much of just spiritual food. And I think that's really what people need.
Hasina Johnson of the East Bay Institute for Urban Arts, speaking with Shireen Meraji. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at art and democracy. Thanks for listening. Laura Levati is our managing director, Peggy Law is executive director, Stephanie Welch is associate producer, our production assistant is Shireen Meraji, Norman Solomon is senior advisor, our national producer is David Barsamian, and I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babich. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.